around the world with reporters.
There are many EU legislators who depict Russia as a dangerous adversary that needs to be restrained. They condemn the imprisonment of opposition figure Alexei Navalny and the handling of protests in Russia.
The European Union needs to send a message by not only considering new sanctions, but also by increasing our support to prosecuted, tortured and repressed voices of the opposition and the civil society.
It's rarely highlighted by mainstream media in the West that Navalny received a prison sentence last month after returning to Russia for breaking the terms of a 2014 suspended prison sentence. Also, Western media never mentioned the global pandemic when reporting on public protests in Russia organized by Navalny supporters. Just last weekend, 500 protesters were arrested here in Brussels, and those detained made claims of police brutality. Mainstream media vilify demonstrators here and in other Western nations for breaking COVID-19 rules, while at the same time portraying protesters in Russia as heroes. The EU and US accused the Russian government of poisoning Alexei Navalny last August. Navalny was treated in Germany after the alleged murder attempt. The Kremlin denies any role and is clearly unhappy that EU authorities refuse to provide medical evidence.
It is quite impolite, mildly speaking, and it is such arrogance from cultural Europe. It seems to me unacceptable and we categorically reject it.
There are many reasons why Brussels should try to improve relations with Moscow, some EU lawmakers insist.
Well, Russia is a capital neighbor. We cannot ignore that the longest neighbor, the longest border, it is with Russia. Russia is not only an energy supplier, it's as well a strategical relation.
A good case in point, a number of EU nations are now scrambling to get their hands on Russia's Sputnik V COVID-19 vaccine, which is more than 90% efficacious. The EU has major vaccine supply issues. Moscow says it's happy to help. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
People are marching on the streets to show support to the people of Kashmir. This rally in Islamabad is part of a series of events in Pakistan organized to mark the Kashmir Solidarity Day. Pakistan observes the day every year on the 5th of February. Pakistan's foreign minister led the rally in Islamabad and urged the international community to play a role in ending the suffering of the people of Kashmir.
The purpose of our today's rally is to express solidarity with the people of Kashmir. The people of Kashmir have been under siege for last 18 months, but we want to make it clear that India cannot suppress the freedom of Kashmir forever.
Kashmir has remained under lockdown since August 5, 2019, when India revoked its special status. Thousands of people have been detained, and over 8 million Kashmiris have little access to the outside world.
We are thankful to the people of Pakistan and the government for supporting us. We are hopeful that Pakistan would continue to support us till Kashmir is liberated from India.
We must understand as the Kashmiris are living under an occupation and oppression for the past 73 years. And the 5th of February marks a day where we, the people of Pakistan particularly, tell the Kashmiris living across the line of control that they are not alone.
Pakistan and India have competing claims on the long-standing Jammu and Kashmir issue. Both claim the region in full but rule on parts of it. They have fought wars over Kashmir. With tensions continue to increase, there is a fear of yet another conflict on the dispute between the two neighbors. The country's Prime Minister visited the Pakistani-administered Kashmir to mark the day.
Prime Minister Imran Khan says Pakistan is ready to take two steps forward if India is willing to seek a political settlement of the long-standing Kashmir dispute. However, given the current hostilities between the two neighbors, experts believe there is a slim chance of any dialogue on Kashmir, at least in the near future. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Boazaji University continue protesting the appointment of AKP-affiliated rector. University academics turned their back to the newly appointed rector's office as a symbol of objection. The academics called for the resignation of Malih Bulu, director that was appointed by Turkish president. Protests have been going for weeks now, with police arresting hundreds. Demonstrations broke out early January, when Turkish president appointed Melih Bulu, an academic with a strong ties with the ruling party, as the new rector for Boğaziçi University. Students and academics complained that the appointment broke a decade-long tradition of Boğaziçi rectors being elected from within the university academic team. The Boğaziçi crisis gathered support from other universities and oppositions, who saw in this new trial from the president to force control over the country after granting himself sweeping powers post-coup attempt in 2016. Erdogan said the protests are not led by students, claiming it is stemmed by opposition parties.
A segment of politics is leading the way for this. It is not possible to describe and accept the protests as incidents about the university students. Turkey's opposition parties, including main opposition, Republican People's Party and E Party, as well as People's Democratic Party, are behind all of this.
Turkish president also slammed the US and France over their reaction to the protest, mentioning the incidents taking place ahead of U.S. elections and calling French President Macron to take care of the Yellow Vest protests in his country before pointing fingers to what is happening in Turkey. Erdogan argued that the law grants the president the authority to appoint rectors and that he had done it before in other universities.
The whole issue broke out after the president appointed the new rector. This isn't against the law, but the problem is that Melih Bulu isn't an academic, and this is against the law. I disagree that the protests were driven by political parties. It started by students. Of course, opposition parties are taking advantage of the protests to lash out at the president.
The government response to the protest came harsh, as peaceful protests have been met with overwhelming violence and arrests. Critics and human rights activists say those are efforts by Erdogan to seize more power, using the coup plot as a scarecrow. The Boğaziçi protest brings to mind the huge Gezi Park protest held years ago, with many saying that it will continue because the problem is in the system itself. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Tensions between Beijing and Washington escalated once again, this time after the U.S.-guided missile destroyer USS John McCain sailed through the Taiwan Strait despite repeated objections from China. The transit was the first such move since the inauguration of Joe Biden as U.S. president. The U.S. Navy claimed the move demonstrates Washington's, quote, commitment to a free and open Indo-Pacific, saying that the U.S. military would, quote, continue to fly, sail, and operate anywhere international law allows. Beijing, however, considers any passing through the waterway as provocative and a breach of its sovereignty. It says such operations threaten stability in the region and embolden separatists on the self-ruled island. China is also strongly against deepening ties between Washington and Taipei, since it sees Taiwan as part of its territory. It has repeatedly called on the United States to respect the One China policy and stop interfering in the country's internal affairs. Taiwan, however, views itself an independent territory. The previous U.S. administration under Donald Trump tried to bolster Taiwan's international standing by sending several high-level envoys to the island. It also approved sales of sophisticated weapons to Taipei, including F-16 fighter jets and advanced missiles. The moves drew strong condemnation from China and caused relations between the two countries to sink to the lowest level in decades. With Biden taking the helm at the White House, there was some optimism that Washington-Beijing ties would improve. However, it so appears that there is no end to the downward spiral. Experts believe Biden is also using Taiwan as a playing card against China.
The Biden administration, despite having quite a bit of experience, is treating Taiwan like it's a playing card. Unfortunately, on the Chinese side, it's not a playing card, it's a red line. So these are the type of very dangerous situations which can, in fact, lead to an armed conflict.
Taiwan is one of the multiple fronts in the Sino-American standoff. The dueling economic powers have been at loggerheads over a host of issues. The U.S. has recently blacklisted several Chinese officials over a new security law in Hong Kong that Washington claims to be against freedom of speech. China, however, says the law will return stability to the economic hub that has been embroiled in anti-government protests for months. China accuses the U.S. and other Western countries of being behind the protests. Washington has also sided with Beijing's rivals in the maritime dispute over the South China Sea and routinely dispatches warships and warplanes to the region. The two sides are also involved in a bitter trade and cyber wars. During Trump's presidency, the U.S. imposed sweeping tariffs on Chinese imports, prompting tit-for-tat measures from China. Experts believe that there is a bipartisan anti-China sentiment among U.S. politicians.
There's a bipartisan anti-China feeling, not only among the American people, but also in Congress.
The recent moves and statements from the Biden administration suggest that tensions between Beijing and Washington are far from over. Biden's policy on China has so far proven to be different from that of Trump's administration, only in rhetoric, not in kind.
Jobs and working conditions are much more in danger today than in normal times. That's why the main French trade unions called for a nationwide strike and demonstrations in order to defend jobs, salaries, and working conditions. The COVID crisis is leading to an important loss of jobs and to an explosion of poverty. Trade union leaders call for a social spring.
The social spring is a formula we use to say that the social question cannot be denied in this difficult period. So the anger we notice every day in the enterprises should find an expression. We want our demands to be heard.
These workers of the big French multinational Total are threatened with dismissal, despite financial support from the state. Other big companies in France, such as the pharmaceutical Sanofi, car constructors Renault and PSA, and Airbus, also benefit from important tax reductions and financial aid from the government. But that does not prevent them to fire workers.
Sanofi receives about 120 million euros every year for research. They pay less taxes and they are going to pay 4 billion euros to their shareholders. Today they announced a record of their profits. Meanwhile, they are firing workers and they did not find a vaccine. There is a problem.
France has not been able to produce its own vaccine, unlike the USA, Russia, China, and even Cuba. A big disappointment for French people. Experts say it's due to the continuous privatization. Scientific research has been sacrificed for short-term profits.
We can't continue with the pharmaceutical industry that's making a huge amount of profit without investing their benefits in research for the general interest. Public research has to be maintained. The fact that Sanofi has not been able to produce a vaccine reveals a real problem in the system.
According to the National Institute for Economic Studies, INSEE, the French gross domestic product, GDP, went down with more than 8% in 2020. Less than expected, but still a record since the Second World War. Unemployment increased with 8%. Nevertheless, the main French companies are making more profits today than before the COVID crisis. Profits for few, sacrifices for many.
It's difficult to organize workers during lockdowns and curfews. Fundamental liberties are put in danger with the COVID crisis. A united front, as shown today in France, is one of the means to go forward. Chris Den Hont, Paris.
Senior leaders of combined opposition parties, including Pakistan People's Party and Muslim League of former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, gathered in Islamabad to decide new course of action after opposition's deadline to Prime Minister Imran Khan to resign expired. After hours-long meeting, they announced that people from all over Pakistan would start a mass long march towards the capital Islamabad on March 26 this year to force the government of Prime Minister Imran Khan to step down and hold fresh general elections. The opposition blames the military to have rigged general elections in favor of Prime Minister Imran Khan in 2018.
We are struggling to get rid of an illegitimate government which was formed through rigging in general elections. We are trying to restore the sanctity of the public mandate.
A better sense must prevail among the opposition parties. The opposition must understand that their protests would not bring down our government. When we were in the opposition, we held protest rallies in Islamabad for 126 days to bring down the government.
The opposition launched a public mobilization campaign late last year across Pakistan to prepare people for the long march next month, something which government believes received a lackluster response. Prime Minister Imran Khan says that the opposition parties turned against him after he rejected their backdoor request to stop prosecuting top opposition leaders on corruption charges. The opposition's decision to start a mass long march has come after anti-graft watchdog started prosecuting top opposition leaders on money laundering charges. The former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has already been convicted on money laundering charges.
Analysts believe that the opposition parties enjoy little public support after their top leaders were tainted with the corruption charges. However, discontentment prevailed among people over unprecedented price hike after Pakistan devalued its currency under IMF pressure, something opposition failed to exploit in its favor. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
February 4th is World Cancer Day, and on this day, thousands of Gazan cancer patients suffer immensely due to the crippling Israeli blockade. After being diagnosed with cancer, patients in Gaza have to wait for months before being able to receive treatment. Gaza hospitals suffer from acute shortage of medicines, especially for cancer patients. Getting an Israeli permit to access the health care needed outside the impoverished enclave can be a stressful and unpredictable process, and many apply multiple times before being able to exit.
Israel usually doesn't allow Palestinian patients to travel through the Erez crossing despite having an exit permit. They only need to leave the Gaza Strip to receive required treatments.
Currently, cancer patients in Gaza suffer acute shortage of the essential drugs needed for their treatment with a 50% deficit rate. Despite the high number of cancer cases in Gaza, the Israeli regime also refuses to allow spare parts for radiation therapy machines to enter Gaza.
Radiation therapy, especially for breast cancer patients, is not available in the Gaza Strip, and patients must go to hospitals in Israel or the occupied West Bank for treatment. Radiation therapy is a hard process and takes a very long time to get an Israeli permit for such procedures. Oftentimes, cancer patients miss their hospital appointments due to delayed exit permits.
There are around 14,000 cancer patients in the Gaza Strip, 47% male and 53% female. Breast cancer is the most commonly diagnosed cancer among females. Cancer patients have also complained of humiliating treatment at the Israeli-controlled Erez crossing.
The process in the Israeli crossing is extremely humiliating because they insist on strip searching you. I was very sick and they kept interrogating me for 3 hours and then they began to strip search me. I told them that I had a mastectomy, but the Israelis did not let me go through until they did a full body search.
Under the current circumstances, the health condition of many cancer patients is likely to further deteriorate. Human rights organizations in the Gaza Strip have repeatedly urged the international community to help bring an end to the Israeli blockade and save the lives of cancer patients. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
According to the International Organization for Migration, at least 600 families were forcibly displaced from their homes in Yemen in January due to the increasing confrontations in several governorates of the country.
The areas controlled by the Saudi-led coalition suffer from instability, insecurity, and the spread of armed groups. Therefore, the residents of these areas are leaving to save their lives from missiles, projectiles, and armed confrontations. These have all been confirmed by the international organizations, including IOM.
The IOM says Al-Hudaydah, Ad-Dala, and Taiz governorates have the highest number of displaced people. As the war continues in these areas, most displacements occurred during the last week of January, indicating that 2021 may witness more of this crisis.
The issue of displacement can only be solved by lifting the imposed siege. Those displaced greatly suffer from the absence of support from international organizations. These people must be among the priorities of the humanitarian operations. It is shameful to see an increase in the number of displaced people in 2021 due to the continuing armed conflicts.
Millions of families had to leave their homes for survival since the beginning of the war in Yemen in 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on the Arab country, killing thousands of civilians, including women and children.
2021 doesn't seem to be better than the previous years for Yemenis as the war continues to create new difficulties for thousands of people who had to migrate for their lives. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has signaled that it is willing to return to the 2015 nuclear deal from which former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally exited in 2018 and reimposed anti-Tehran sanctions. But 2 weeks after taking the helm at the White House, Washington's return to the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, still hangs in the balance. The U.S. says Iran should first come back to full compliance with the accord, but Tehran says it was Washington that walked away and hence it should fulfill all its obligations, which include the lifting of all sanctions. Amid the standoff, Iran's foreign minister warned that the Biden administration has a limited window of opportunity to re-enter the agreement. He, meanwhile, suggested the question over who must take the first step in returning to the JCPOA could be resolved by EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell.
He can put his hat as the coordinator of the joint position and sort of choreograph the actions that are needed to be taken by the United States and the actions that are needed to be taken by Iran.
In reaction, the European Union said it is working extremely hard to salvage the deal and is in talks with the U.S. administration to see if sanctions could be lifted. And this is how the U.S. reacted to Zarif's suggestion.
If Iran comes back into full compliance with its obligations under the JCPOA, the United States would do the same. And then we would then use that as a platform to build a longer and a stronger agreement that also addresses other areas of concern.
Such a stance was earlier echoed by Secretary of State Antony Blinken, which is in line with Washington's policy to expand the JCPOA beyond Iran's nuclear issue. French President Emmanuel Macron has also said Saudi Arabia should be involved in any new negotiations with Iran about the deal. But Iran's president has reiterated that the JCPOA remains unchanged.
I clearly tell the global community, and especially the countries in the JCPOA, whether it's 4+1 or maybe 5+1 in the future, that no clause of the JCPOA will change. Know this, and no one will be added to it.
After the U.S. pullout of the JCPOA in May 2018, Iran waited for a year and gave leeway to the European signatories, the EU, Britain, France, and Germany, to make up for the U.S. move. They, however, failed to live up to their commitments. Iran then reacted by scaling back on its commitments under the accord. Iran says its measures are fully reversible upon the full compliance by the remaining signatories. Presently, questions arise as whether the Biden administration will follow the path of its predecessor against Iran or will try to rectify the Trump-era policy, which has been described as a failed approach even by some of Washington's close allies.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
جانم تپشم سخنم باشد وطنم وطنم ای خان که گوهر خیز بهره وطنم قدمم عشقم سخنم قسمم از عاشقی لبری.
Congratulations on the victory anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. limelight.
Arizona aid groups refute thousands of 911 calls routed to the Border Patrol. They uncovered inaction, indifference, and obstruction, says Ryan Devereaux, investigative journalist, in an article published under the heading, U.S. Border Patrol calls itself a humanitarian organization. A new report says that's a lie. Stay tuned for the details, please. For more than two decades, the U.S. Border Patrol has told a story about the role it plays in the Southwest. Confronted with the fact that thousands of migrants have died across the border during those years, the agency has produced dramatic videos of agents conducting rescues, invited reporters to demonstrations showcasing its life-saving skills, and pointed to the existence of its specialized search and rescue unit. The efforts are used to drive home a talking point common among Border Patrol officials, one in which the most militarized component of the nation's largest police agency is also the border's largest humanitarian organization. A new report from two of the border's leading non-governmental humanitarian organizations calls this narrative into question, arguing that a close examination of Border Patrol responses to migrants in distress proves that militarized law enforcement and the provision of humanitarian aid do not mix. Left to Die, Border Patrol Search and Rescue and the Crisis of Disappearance, published recently by No More Deaths, a faith-based organization based in Tucson, Arizona, and the Coalition of Humans, an organization that has provided humanitarian aid on the border since 1990s, analyzes hundreds of emergency cases recorded by a non-governmental crisis line and more than 2,100 calls routed by Pima County Sheriff's Department 911 dispatchers to the Border Patrol over a two-year period. But her stress by further analysis of Border Patrol press releases and interviews, the 122-page report documented evidence of inaction, indifference, and obstruction to reports of missing migrants. The Border Patrol has monopolized emergency services for undocumented people in the borderlands, the report said, crowding out other resources of humanitarian aid while failing to provide those services on its own. In the face of a humanitarian catastrophe that's taken a minimum of nearly 10,000 lives, the report concluded that the Border Patrol's systematic negligence toward emergency reports of undocumented people in distress constitutes a state crime of historic proportions. The conflict of interest between Border Patrol's enforcement mission and its directive to search for and rescue those in distress on U.S. soil is precisely why international governmental bodies mandate the strict separation of humanitarian and military activities during human rights emergencies, the report said. Border Patrol as an agency and Border Patrol agents in the field cannot reasonably advance both humanitarian, political and military objectives simultaneously. Joshua Heyman, director of the Center for Inter-American and Border Studies at the University of Texas at El Paso, has spent years studying the culture of the Border Patrol and the consequences of its operations. He agreed that Border Patrol's core identity and mission made it impossible for the agency to ever be considered a properly functioning humanitarian organization. ever since. The post-9/11 creation of Customs and Border Protection, the agency that oversees the Border Patrol, debate has raged in policy circles about how the federal government's immigration agencies should balance enforcement versus the provision of services. Heyman noted, among those agencies, he said, Border Patrol is the most purely enforcement-minded. From 2015 through 2016, the organization Derechos Humanos received thousands of calls on a hotline established for migrants in distress. 456 of those calls were deemed emergencies, and 89 involved a call to the Border Patrol requesting that the agency conduct a search. The report found that the Border Patrol took no confirmed action in 60% of the cases where a search was requested. In 40% of those cases, the Border Patrol directly stated to families and or humanitarian respondents that the agency would not conduct any search or rescue response for a known distressed person, the report said. In 16 of these instances, Border Patrol's direct refusal to respond to a reported emergency resulted in the distressed person's death or disappearance. In a quarter of the emergency cases fielded by Derechos Humanos, the report found that the Border Patrol obstructed the process through a variety of means. Examples included agents directing families and humanitarian groups to non-working phone numbers or providing them with false information, such as telling family members that their loved ones had been found alive when that was not true. In one case, aid volunteers sought assistance from the Border Patrol's elite search and rescue team. According to the report, an agent told the volunteers it was too hot for the government team to operate. In another case, a volunteer called to report a missing teenager last seen in a dangerous area, roughly 15 miles north of the border. According to the Left to Die report, Border Patrol told the responding crisis line volunteer that the agency would not activate a search for the unaccompanied minor because they didn't work that far south. The report found that when the Border Patrol did activate searches, the operations tended to last less than a day and in some cases less than an hour. The report classified nearly a third of those cases as disappearance, meaning that the missing person was never rescued, nor were their remains located, recovered, or identified. This stands in stark contrast to government-led search and rescue efforts in the borderlands involving U.S. citizens, the organizations noted. The Pima County Sheriff's Department has a near 100% success rate for lost citizens, the report said, adding that government agencies searching for distressed U.S. citizens very rarely call off their efforts without locating the subject. The authors argued that the Border Patrol's failure rate was a clear indication of systematic and deadly discrimination. Customs and Border Protection, the nation's largest police agency, told The Intercept in a statement that it remains committed to humanely securing the southern border of the United States and devotes totality of its force to finding lost or injured individuals while also balancing the border security mission with which they are charged. In the days leading up to the recent report, CBP published a feature-length article in Frontline, the agency's in-house magazine, touting the Border Patrol's humanitarian efforts. The article noted how extraordinarily deadly the summer of 2020 was for migrants crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. As The Intercept reported in January, the Pima County Medical Examiner's Office closed out 2020 having nearly broken its 10-year record for most migrant remains received in a year, single year or the weekend. The Guardian reported that the state's record was officially broken. The article noted that CBP personnel saved more than 5,000 people and conducted 1,400 search and rescue operations in fiscal year 2020. The figures were accompanied by a 2,400-word profile of the agency's Border Patrol, Search, Trauma, and Rescue Team, better known as BORSTAR, which casting all blame for death on the border, on the smugglers, and showing how the federal government is responding. It was precisely the kind of public framing targeted in the No More Deaths report. What those measures are ultimately aimed at is legitimizing the agency that's actually causing the crisis and sort of positioning them as somehow the saviors. Max Granger, a longtime humanitarian aid volunteer and co-author of the report, told The Intercept, "The evidence shows that the Border Patrol's sought after legitimacy is wholly unwarranted," he argued. "What we found in the report is that Border Patrol as an agency is twice as likely to cause a person to become lost and in distress in the desert than they are to rescue anyone." A lack of transparency as to how the Border Patrol defines and tracks its rescues makes a serious problem much worse, the No More Deaths Directors Humanus report argued. Examining a sample of about 160 press releases describing Border Patrol rescues from 2015 to 2016, the organizations concluded that more than half actually described a routine arrest, including a 2018 rescue in which Border Patrol agents in Arizona chased an 18-year-old through a wilderness with a helicopter, causing him to nearly drown in a cattle pond. At least 91 of the 456 emergency cases logged by the Directors Humanus Crisis Line involved a so-called Border Patrol chase and a scatter incident when agents descend on groups of migrants, often with helicopters, to break them up so they are easier to catch, the report said. In other words, approximately one in five emergencies involve distressed individuals having been chased but not arrested by the Border Patrol agents in remote areas. In a statement, CBP said that the Border Patrol defines rescues as incidents where lack of intervention by the Border Patrol could result in death or serious bodily injury to suspected undocumented migrants, and added that rescues of Border Patrol agents, U.S. citizens, and other individuals lawfully in the United States are also reportable. The agency added that from fiscal year 2015 through fiscal year 2020, the Border Patrol responded to 4,576 unique events for emergency calls for individuals in loss or in distress, resulting in 8,518 successful rescues.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon you all. And you're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing, only on IRIB English Radio. In this program, we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. And the answers are mostly based upon the book Children in Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. I'm Hassan, and we have our guest speaker with us, Brother Miqdad. He's an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Salaamu alaikum, Brother Miqdad, and thank you for joining us with the show.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. The pleasure is all mine.
So, dear listeners, we're discussing about giving hope to our children, and we're looking into the question that I read somewhere that it's important to give hope to our children, hope about the future. Is this correct? If yes, then how do we do it? And in the last program, we discussed how to keep balance and, you know, how to have realistic goals. And now I would like to ask you, Brother Miqdad, how can we increase hope in our children?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. One of the ways to increase hope in our children is to give them challenges. Give them challenges that are realistic and they are able to achieve.
Yeah.
And when they are successful and achieve the challenge, then children acquire this feeling of achievement, this feeling of success.
Mm-hmm.
And they realize that they are able to do things.
Mm-hmm.
And from that, what happens is that they have this hope in them,
mm-hmm.
that I'm really able to do things. So first practical thing is challenge your children.
Yeah.
Challenge your children with challenges that are at times difficult,
mm-hmm.
at times require struggle and effort,
mm-hmm.
but a child is able to do it, and let the success be there and bold the success, basically.
Uh-huh.
Celebrate the success. That's very important. Children should realize that my efforts at the end led to a very important result.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, is that put them in situations where they need to have hope, where it requires a thought, it requires a convincing yourself, talking to yourself. And one of the best ways I can think of is mountain climbing,
mm-hmm.
right? Mountain climbing is very special because whilst you're climbing the mountain, you can see the summit.
Does it make them having hope?
Yes. See, when you're climbing the mountain, you can see the peak.
Uh-huh.
You can see the summit, right?
Yeah.
And you know where you're going.
Mm-hmm.
And whilst you're walking, you can see the goal in front of you. And
yeah.
you see yourself going towards it. And actually, with every step, you can see yourself being closer and closer to the goal. And what that makes is that it makes a person understand what hope is.
Mm-hmm.
Because every step you take, it's difficult. I'm really tired.
Yeah.
I'm thirsty. I'm struggling. My back is hurting.
Mm-hmm.
But if I take one step, then I'm closer to the goal,
yeah.
right? And this teaches one hope, what
mm-hmm.
hope really means, mm-hmm. right? And this is a time where you convince yourself. This time where you speak to one another, you encourage one another, you
yeah.
help one another. And this is where really you can teach a child what hope
mm-hmm.
is. And at that time, if you're able to have that moment, basically, this is a moment that remains for life,
yeah.
basically. When you go to those mountain climbings where you're really tired, but you have to give another extra 2 kilometers to reach, basically, another extra push to reach, and you're doing it together as a family, for example, or friends together, and you encourage each other, and you tell yourself that Allah is helping us, that we've got Allah's help over here because we're full of hope, and you're learning about hope.
So this was like about children having hope, so and they can have hope through different things.
So this was two points. Another point, perhaps an extremely important one and very practical, is that we need to create role models for our children.
Mm-hmm.
We've mentioned time and time again about this concept of role model. What happens is that role models give us hope. Role models give us this feeling that we too can achieve,
mm-hmm.
right? And again, this is something that is very natural we see around us, that when you take somebody as role model, what happens is that inside you think for yourself, that if this person did it, then I can too.
It's just a goal for us.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, if you take the Ahlul Bayt as your goals, mm-hmm. as your role models,
yeah.
then what happens is that you think that you are able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
That if he could, I can too.
Yeah.
Now, this requires a very important prerequisite, and that is that the Ahlul Bayt were like us.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We have this concept in the Holy Quran as well a lot, that
mm-hmm.
when the prophets used to come to the people and say that, I received a revelation,
mm-hmm.
and Allah has brought me to you to guide you and take you to Allah.
Mm-hmm.
The people, they thought that the Prophet cannot receive revelation,
mm-hmm.
that this is not true. They said, but you're just like us. You're like
uh-huh.
a human being like us.
Yeah.
What they failed to realize is that they were supposed to do it the other way around. They were supposed to realize, oh, if the Prophet did it, then we too are able to do it. This is what the Prophet was saying.
Mm-hmm.
When they said, oh, but you're nothing but a human being, the Prophet didn't say that, no, in fact, yes, you're right, I'm different. Mm-hmm. No, the Prophet said, yes, in fact, you're right, I am a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And because I'm a human being, I'm there to be a role model for you. And because I'm a human being, I'm a role model for you to take you where I also were able to reach, and you too are able to reach. Right? So this is very crucial, that when we introduce the Ahlul Bayt as our role models, we too realize that if they achieve something, we are able to achieve as well.
That's interesting, actually. And let's take a short break over here. And your audience, stay tuned. We'll be right back after a short break.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this israf to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to your audience, and we're talking about having a role model in our lives, which sets a goal for us. So Brother Miqdad, please continue.
So this is extremely important, that if we're able to introduce the Ahlul Bayt to our children and introduce the Ahlul Bayt in the best of ways and show how perfect human beings they were in all aspects, in their physical dimension, in their spiritual dimension, in their emotional dimension, in their social dimension, whether it be their akhlaq, whether it be their knowledge, the knowledge of the ghaib that they had, the knowledge that they had of everything around them, the understanding that they had of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, as well as their spirituality, the length of their ibadat, how they would understand Allah, how much love they had for Allah, their station in terms of the station of infallibility, the station of shafa'ah, the station of shahada, all these things, if we're able to introduce the children to this. And
so, but it isn't like, you know, Ahlul Bayt can be a role model just in terms of spirituality?
No, they can be role models for everything. If we're able to tell our children that these are the perfect human beings that we had, that existed in this world, they're real. And they were human beings like us. If they've achieved, they came back to tell us so we too can achieve, right? In all the different aspects, right? Their spirituality is role model for us, an example for us. But not only that, also the way they behaved in society, right? Their leadership, their time management, right? Their time with their children and their spouse, the time that they had with their friends. All these things are what they do is that they create a role model, and they give us hope.
So we have to tell them about the life of Ahlul Bayt.
But in this way, that you tell them that they were able to achieve this, we too are able to achieve this. And we have hope in us that through effort and through struggles that we talked about, it won't come just overnight. You have to work for it. If we work for it, then we can become like them as well.
So examples help us reaching our goal.
Examples and role models, yes.
Yeah, that's true. And dear audience, let's take a break, and we'll join you after a short break.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to your audience, and before the break, we were discussing about setting our role models. And Brother Mehdi, I have a question. That it's sometimes that children have hope for themselves, that I need to reach so-and-so position in so-and-so position. I want to become like so-and-so, anything it might be. But sometimes what happens is parents have, you know, hope from the children.
Yes, parents also should have hope in their children, in the sense that parents should think that their children are able to achieve a lot in this life and be successful both in this world and the hereafter. However, parents should also realize that this would not come except by the children's own will, right?
Yeah. Because, you know, having hope for ourselves is like our own choice. When parents having hope for the children, it's their choice.
Exactly. It's the choice of the children in the end of the day. It doesn't happen. So it doesn't happen if however much you want it, you can't force it, right? As parents, we can't force our children to do something or achieve a level of success. At the end of the day, we have to realize as parents, and this is a realization, and it's an understanding that we have, that if we are parents, we want the best for our children, and we hope that they are able to achieve success in this world and in the hereafter. But at the end of the day, we have to realize that this is only through the child's own decision, through a child's own effort, through a child's own...
Isn't it true that parents know what's better for their child?
Parents know what's best for the children up to a certain extent. Right, and as we talked about previously as well, that at the end of the day, children only prepare the groundwork. Right, they only make sure that the ground is ready for a child to make their own decisions. Yeah. A child to make through their own free will choose the path they want to achieve. So, parents just help their children. Right, but at the end of the day, success is only through one's choice. And so, a child who makes a decision, puts the effort towards it, bears the difficulty, and is able to reach the goal. And as parents, we have hope. And on top of hope, not only just that, but we need to have dua as well. We need to ask Allah to help our children. And this dua is very important. It's crucial for this journey. The more we pray to Allah, the more this has an effect on our children. And the children are able to make their own right decision, their own decisions through their own free will, and able to reach the goal.
Yeah, so like if, you know, parents having hope for their children, and it's, you know, children don't have, you know, they don't have the will, so they won't put efforts in it.
Definitely.
So that was an amazing discussion, Brother Mehdi. Thank you so much for joining with us on this program, and thank you so much to your audience for joining us on the program. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at our email englishradio@irib.ir and visit us at our website parstoday.com. Until the next program, fi amanullah.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life. A complete way, it's a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 49 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.